I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. The body of former President George Herbert Walker Bush is lying in state under the rotunda in the U.S. Capitol. Speaking yesterday at a ceremony, Vice President Mike Pence called him a great leader who made a difference in the life of this nation. Last night, President Trump and the First Lady paid their respects. The funeral will take place tomorrow at Washington National Cathedral when Bush will be eulogized by his son and namesake, former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, former Senator Alan Simpson, and Bush biographer John Meacham. In fact, later in the show, I'll talk with Meacham about Bush and with Jeet Heer from The New Republic about how he sees Bush's legacy. We want to know how you think about 41. Give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We begin our conversation with Joe Watkins. He worked in the Bush White House. He's a commentator for MSNBC. I should add a semi-regular here on Radio Times, the Philly-based guy himself. Joe Watkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And I should say to our listeners, you're joining us by car somewhere in America, but you are not at the wheel and obviously talking with us on Radio Times. What was it like to work in the Bush White House?
Well, in retrospect, it was just a wonderful opportunity to work for such a great man. President Bush had a very, very good heart. And the thing that I think stands out with most of the people that worked with him and for him was the kind of person that he was, that he was thoughtful, that he was kind. He went out of his way to be kind, I think. And that was very special. He was very humble. He didn't try to attract attention to himself. He didn't talk about himself. He didn't talk about what he had done or where he'd been or what he had accomplished. He was more interested in knowing about you, and he was more interested in lifting up people who might otherwise be overlooked. And I thought that was very special about him. And being a staffer and accompanying him to meetings and just watching him with people. And with the people that I brought in to meet with him, I noticed this about him. And I just thought, what a special human being he was.
Well, it's interesting you say that he did not like to talk about himself. What do you think, Joe, he would make of all these tributes and people waxing nostalgic and as, I mean, almost putting this guy, you know, on a pedestal?
Right.
What would he made of that?
He would have not liked it. He would have said, you know, please, you know, cut with all this stuff now. Stop, you know. Cut with the accolades, you know. I just did my job and tried to do the best I could at it. I just was trying to serve my country and do what was right, and that was the mark of the man. I mean, he was always trying to do what was right, the right thing, even if it meant that he might be prevented from having a second term in the presidency. He was more committed to doing the right thing for the country than he was for himself. And he didn't like that kind of stuff. He didn't like, you know, people giving long ovations and giving flowery speeches and waxing eloquent about him. He was much more content just doing the right thing and actually almost being in the background as he did it. But he was president of the United States. He realized the importance of his role as president. And I think he did it very, very well.
Well, I was also thinking of his mother as all these tributes have come in because she's the one that basically told him, don't brag on yourself.
Don't be a braggadocia. That's right. He would always say that. You know, my mother said, don't be a braggadocia. You don't talk about yourself. You know, you don't do that. And he didn't. I mean, he listened to that and did not do that. And I think America, certainly in retrospect, appreciates the quality of the man. The fact that he didn't do that, that he was so self-effacing, that he was humble, you know, somebody born to means and to wealth, and yet and still didn't make much about it. He just and got to know everybody at the White House, Marty. You should know that the president was the kind of man that knew everybody, including the people that emptied the trash in his office. And he would not only know what their names were, but he would know about their families. And he would ask them, he would engage them and say, hey, how's your son? Is your son in the hospital still? When's he getting out? How's he doing? Is he doing better? And then he would pen these little notes. Sometimes he would type them on a little typewriter he had. And then he would handwrite a note. He even wrote a couple notes to me, which was so nice and thoughtful. Wrote a nice note to my son. He met my son one day at the White House. I brought my son in to work with me, and I was walking to the West Wing, and we ran into Dan Quayle, my former boss. I had worked for Dan Quayle when he was in the Senate. And the president, Dan and the president were giving a press conference outside the West Wing, and Dan said to me, "Has the president met your son yet?" I said, "No, just hold on one second. Let him finish talking to reporters. I want him to meet your boy." And so the president came over and met my son and said, "Joey, how are you? your dad works for me, and I see him all the time." And he shook his hand and talked to him for a few minutes. And then when I brought the picture to him for him to write a note to my son, he just wrote a beautiful note to my boy, and then was kind enough to mention me at the bottom of the note as well. Just typical of President George H.W. Bush, very, very thoughtful, always thinking of others, and never too busy to take time to say hi to somebody.
I do want to play an excerpt from his speech, his inauguration in 1989, where he makes this reference to a kinder and gentler nation. Let's just hear. It's only 20 seconds. Let me just hear this, and then, Joe, I want to get your response.
America is never wholly herself unless she is engaged in high moral principle. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world.
Joe, what was he saying there? And some people have said that this was his way of essentially turning his back or the country's back on Ronald Reagan.
Well, I think he was just trying to put his imprint on the presidency to come, to say that while he was president, that's what he wanted to see for America. He wanted to the country to be a kinder, gentler place, that he didn't want to see random loss of life, even in conflicts, in world conflicts, such as in the Persian Gulf conflict. He didn't want to see any unreasonable loss of life. He didn't want to, oftentimes in these conflicts, there's what they call mission creep, where you're supposed to do one thing and you end up doing more. He didn't want there to be any mission creep. He didn't want there to be any undue loss of life, because he had once been a soldier and had put his life on the line. And he didn't want to do that to other people's kids. So he thought that even in our daily deportment, it would be the mark of America should be that we are kinder, that we are gentler, and that we care about other people. And that's who he was in his daily deportment. He was a kind person. He was a gentle person. He wasn't harsh. You could talk to anybody that worked for him. You didn't see him yelling and screaming. He didn't yell at staff. He didn't throw people out of his office. He didn't have temper tantrums. He really was a kinder man and a gentler man. And I think that as we remember him, you'll hear that over and over and over again today and tomorrow from the people that that knew him best.
You just didn't want to campaign against him, and much has been made about his vote against the Civil Rights Act in 1964 when he was running for Congress. Also, the infamous Willie Horton ad. I'll be talking more about that later in the show, but the infamous Willie Horton ad when he was running for president against Michael Dukakis. Joe, how do you make sense of those, of how he seemed to separate campaigning from governing? And when it came to campaigning, it was the gloves came off.
Well, I think that in retrospect, most human beings feel that they wish they could do some things differently than they did. And I think that he would be much the same, that that there were things that he might have done differently if he had the chance. Clearly, Willie Horton would have been one of them.
He never apologized for it.
Not to my knowledge, but he did make up for, I mean, he evolved certainly on the civil rights issue, as we know. I wouldn't have been working for him had he not. I mean, when he finally got elected to Congress in 1968 in Houston, he supported fair housing, which was not popular at all in his district. But he felt when he got there, when he finally got elected, that it was important to level the playing field for all Americans, that people of color ought to have a chance to live wherever they wanted to live and not be banned from living someplace because of the color of their skin. And then when I worked with him in the White House, I saw him do some things that nobody else. I mean, not only did he sign a civil rights bill and also the Americans with Disabilities Act, which I thought was a wonderful piece of legislation, but at the same time he named people of color to positions that had never been done before by a sitting president. He and his wife did that. I mean, Mrs. Bush named Anna Perez to be her press secretary, the first African-American woman to serve as a press secretary to a first lady. And President Bush had unprecedented numbers of African-Americans in his cabinet and on his staff. not the least of whom would be Colin Powell and Leon Dr. Sullivan, who was Lou Sullivan, who was the head of HHS, and the list goes on. He even had named the first black special assistant to the president. That is the person who travels everywhere with the president. Tim McBride worked with him from 85 to 90 when he was vice president, the first term of president. And then he named Bruce Kaufman, a friend of mine, an African-American, a military who had been a military aide. He named him to be his special assistant, to go with him everywhere and to be by his side 24 hours a day. I give him great credit for doing those good things and for reaching out, for inviting the Tuskegee Airmen to the White House to honor them. They had never before been honored by an American president for their service in the Second World War. And he brought them to the White House, to the East Room, and thanked them for what they had done for their service to the country. So he made a lot of great strides as president of the United States. And he was pro-civil rights as the president, which I'm happy about. But I'm sure that if he had to do it over again, if he was still alive, there would be some things that he would do differently. And certainly, I would hope that he'd want to not do Willie Horton.
Sure, sure. And I don't know, a couple of minutes and we have to say goodbye to you, Joe. Let me just read a tweet from Edward saying H.W. Bush signed the ADA, making it law. I think that was the best thing that he did.
Yes.
Let me make a weird segue to Saturday Night Live, but this is President George Herbert Walker Bush making a special appearance on SNL. This is 1994. He's with Dana Carvey, known, of course, for his – excuse me, Dana Carvey, known for his impersonations of Bush.
Dana, George Bush here. I'm watching you do your impression of me, and I gotta say, it's nothing like me. Bears no resemblance. It's bad. It's bad.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I think it's a fair impression.
Don't see it.
You don't?
It's totally exaggerated. Not me, those crazy hand gestures. The pointing thing, I don't do them. And also, na-ga-da, never said it. In all my years of government service, I never once said na-ga-da.
Is that true, Joe? He never said na-ga-da that you know of?
Not that I know. Carvey's invitation was just excellent and so funny. And he invited him to the White House, actually. I mean, the president had a great sense of humor. So that was just a special, special piece of Saturday Night Live.
What does his death mean to you?
Well, it gives us a chance to remember what he did and who he was and the difference that he made and the tone that he set. Clearly, it makes us remember how wonderful it can be when there's bipartisanship, when people work across the aisles to get things done. And when we had a president who was kinder and gentler and so very thoughtful and humble as this president was. I think those are all things that we remember today. And in his death, he wouldn't want to be made larger in death than he was in life. But he was a good and great man. And I'm glad that we're having a chance to remember him as we celebrate his life.
Joe Watkins, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Joe Watkins, based here in Philadelphia, and he worked in the Bush White House as an aide. We've got Jeet here from the New Republic joining us. We'll be talking more about the legacy of George Herbert Walker Bush. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, there's been a lot of talk about former President George Herbert Walker Bush since his death on Friday, about his long career in government, his devotion to his family, his decency, his signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act of 1990. But it seems only right and fitting to also acknowledge the more unsavory parts of his legacy, the infamous Willie Horton ad, Iran-Contra, his record on LGBTQ issues. We asked Jeet here to join us. He's a staff writer for The New Republic and wrote a piece about the former president titled The Whitewashing of George H.W. Bush. Jeet here, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
So what do you make of all the tributes, the praise, the eulogies, deserved, undeserved? How do you see President Bush?
Well, I certainly think The personal tributes are very touching, and I was listening to what Joe had just said, who knew the former president, and I think many people have, who knew him personally have said the same thing. I think it's a very common to speak of his sort of humility, his decency, his kindness to people around him. And I think those are very important things to remember. But, I mean, he was a political figure mm-hmm. and deserves to be seen as part of history, and history is always complicated. And I think with Bush, it's particularly complicated because he tried to straddle between two different strands of the Republican Party. I mean, he's a Republican through and through, like by pedigree. His father was a Republican senator, and Prescott Bush represented the more sort of moderate wing of the Republican Party. He famously stood up against Joseph McCarthy and supported civil rights. George Herbert Walker Bush came of age when the Republican Party was moving to the right. Mm. And he first ran for election under Goldwater, and that was the context in which he opposed civil rights. But I think he always tried to straddle between those two wings. Like he, I think many of his instincts were towards moderation. I mean, he had been, when he was younger, a member of Planned Parenthood and had supported reproductive freedom, but the party was moving in a different direction. And I think the really crucial period is the late 70s and 1980 when he ran against Ronald Reagan and came in a strong sort of second, but he, you know, stood against supply-side economics, called it voodoo economics, and was also critical of some of the sort of social conservatism. But with Reagan's triumph, Bush really, you know, was a party man, and he went along with that.
Well, you know, JT, let me just jump in here. And you put a lot on the table, and I want to sort of break some of this stuff apart. I was talking with Joe Watkins about how 41 was a brutal campaigner. I mean, there's absolutely no question about what he did, especially against Michael Dukakis. This takes us, of course, up to the 1988 presidential election. But let me play this Willie Horton ad, this infamous ad from the 1988 campaign, and then we'll talk about it.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
This came from Lee Atwater and others. In fact, Lee Atwater's apologized for the ad, I believe, almost on his deathbed. But it played on white fears. And then-candidate Bush really pushed this Willie Horton story and message really hard.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think that's is definitely part of his shameful legacy. I mean, as I said, he tried to straddle between the two wings. And I think he also had this kind of very WASP compartmentalization. Like he'd sort of separated out campaigning from governing. And, you know, campaigning was what you hired people like Atwater and Roger Ailes to do. And you could be as dirty as you want. And then when you govern, you try to be more moderate. And so I think, I mean, there's no question that the Horton ad was very racist. And I think it was even beyond that. I mean, he referred to Dukakis as the Greek, you know, as if, like, you know, being a Greek American makes you somehow less of an American. And there was a lot of demagogic issues about flag burning and, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance. And so it was a very nasty demagogic campaign. And I think part of it also has to do with his position in the Republican Party, that a lot of conservatives didn't trust him. A lot of the hard right didn't trust him. And he had to prove his, he had to win those people over. And that's how he did it, unfortunately. And I think that was a real stain on America, and I don't think it should be forgotten.
Well, and I do want to talk about his foreign policy. We got some folks that want to join the conversation as well. To his credit, overseeing the end of the Cold War, he did not go to Berlin to gloat when the wall came down. Yeah. And much has been said, it's almost a cliche by now, but to say that the Cold War ended essentially without a shot being fired, does he deserve credit for that?
Yes, he does. I would give him. I think he was one of the most adept foreign policy presidents, and he had a great team. And I think he really represented a tradition which has gone into abeyance, which is the sort of Republican realist, the tradition of Republicans who are very pragmatic, who understand the world, and who engage in diplomacy. And he was also a strong believer in alliances, which I think is very important to remember. He, you know, believed in NATO. He believed in the United Nations. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, he put together a coalition through the United Nations. So this is really a tradition of Republican internationalism. And his handling of the Cold War, it's an astonishing thing if you think about it, that to have this massive empire contract and go away, and all these sort of things like the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany, one of the major events of our lifetime, all done so peacefully. There's been some criticism, like Gorbachev has occasionally mentioned that he felt he could have used a little bit more support in, but I think in general, it is one of the really high points of American foreign policy.
Let me just raise one or two more things, and then again we'll get some folks in on the conversation. But after Operation Desert Storm, he did encourage the Shiites and the Kurds to rise up against Saddam Hussein. They did, and the United States did not come to their aid.
Yeah, I think the ending of the war in Iraq is very problematic, and I think in some ways that's part of his legacy that we're still living with. I mean, the United States is still in the Middle East as a sort of byproduct of a lot of things that he did. I mean, but I think one thing I will say is that in the terms of the Middle East, he made mistakes, but he made the same mistakes that other presidents, Democratic and Republicans, have made. I think America has not been able to figure out how to achieve its security in the Middle East without getting entangled in alliances with very nasty regimes and without sending military troops in. So I think the same problems that he faced were subsequently faced by all presidents, and it's part of a larger system that transcends him.
That's Ajit Hir. He's a staff writer for The New Republic. Wrote a piece about former President George Herbert Walker Bush, 41, as we affectionately call him or casually call him. And the piece that Ajit Hir wrote is titled The Whitewashing of George H.W. Bush. Let me read an email from Tommy. Could your guest speak about the Iran-Contra scandal? Bush claimed that he was, quote, out of the loop, that he had no knowledge about the covert action of the Reagan administration. I've always had trouble believing since Bush was so plugged into the intelligence community. And this is a question about his role in Iran-Contra, where there was the government essentially selling weapons to Iran. These were secret weapon sales. The money then diverted to fight the Contras, give money to the Contras to fight the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. This was in violation of congressional laws or amendments. What do you see as his role in Iran-Contra?
Yeah, I think that Iran-Contra unfortunately stands as a successful cover-up. I mean, the claim that he was out of the loop doesn't really stand, since he was at meetings. And more importantly, the special counsel noted this, that he had diaries which they weren't able to look at during a crucial period of investigation. But finally, he pardoned many of the key officials who had been indicted, Caspar Weinberger, Robert McFarlane, and Elliot Abrams. And I think that's a very dangerous thing in a constitutional republic, to have president or vice president who had been involved in possibly criminal acts pardoning people he was associated with. Donald Trump pardons Paul Manafort and Roger Stone, he will be able to cite George H.W. Bush as a predecessor.
Let me get some callers in. We've got David. David is calling us from Philadelphia. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment on the fact that, Bush actually oversaw a lot of the critical periods of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, in which his government and his administration did very little, as well as having ruled over the culture wars, the NEA, and all of those other things that happened during his presidency.
David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gee, let me just add a tweet from Jay, who says, wasn't H.W. the guy who banned HIV-positive people from coming, from entering America? He stigmatized people. It took a long time to undo that damage. How do you see his legacy on LGBTQ issues, or specifically on AIDS? It should be added that under the ADA, he addressed some of the concerns and even discrimination against people with AIDS.
Yeah, there was like some progress, but on the whole, it's not a good record. And again, the political context is this was during Reagan and Bush, the Republican Party became increasingly wedded to the religious right, and he gave the religious right a real veto over a lot of these issues. So, for example, under his government, research into teen suicide among gay youth was banned, and the sort of ban of gays in the military was upheld. And so there's a lot of progress. There was a lot of stuff that was really done badly. And this was the era where ACT UP had to do like real direct action and protests to get the government to pay attention to AIDS. So again, this is not a more positive side of his legacy. I think it's just undeniable that the AIDS crisis was much worse because there was a government in power that was beholden to the religious right, and for that reason, unwilling to address the crisis.
Let me read an email from Neela. David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we should add that George Herbert Walker Bush was able to put two people on the U.S. Supreme Court, David Souter and Clarence Thomas. And Neela says, unfortunately, I've never forgiven the first President Bush for nominating Clarence Thomas. His unremarkable career as a less intelligent clone of Justice Scalia has effectively deprived the African-American community of being represented by a truly distinguished jurist who would have had a prominent civil rights and a worthy successor to Justice Thurgood Marshall. Jeet, how do you see the nomination and then, of course, the confirmation, as contentious as it was, of Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think right now a lot of people are mourning Bush because he represents an alternative to Donald Trump. And in many ways, he does in terms of his personal decency. But I think the Thomas hearing, the Thomas nomination shows the continuity that, you know, in both cases, you have a president who's willing to push through, you know, a nominee who has credible allegations of sexual harassment against them. And I think that, I mean, Clarence Thomas, it really depends. There are you know, many conservatives who admire him, but I don't think that this is I think that his nomination was shameful for all the reasons that the listener outlined.
Let me play another clip, and this is President George Herbert Walker Bush speaking at the 1988 Republican National Convention, making this famous promise.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes.
And of course, Jeet, we know that he agreed with the Democrats, raised taxes. Does that explain his one-term presidency?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, he sort of kind of straddled between the different wings of the Republican Party. He kind of alienated people on all sides. But I mean, on the taxes, I mean, I think that this sort of speaks to how complicated he was, because the fact is that I don't think he ever really bought into supply-side economics. He belonged to the older school of Republicans that, you know, believed that deficits were a real problem. And I think he's probably going to be the last Republican in history that, you know, raised taxes to deal with the deficit. Because, you know, from Reagan to Bush Jr. to Trump, there's a lot less fiscal responsibility.
Do you think he also helped make President Clinton a successful president, at least when it came to the economy?
Yeah, I think that Bush, in terms of raising taxes, actually did the right thing. And people who praise him for his character are right to point this out, that he was willing to do the right thing, even if it cost him politically. And it was good for the economy, and therefore one of the beneficiaries was Bill Clinton.
Here's an email from Warren who says, I think when Bush did not get reelected and we had Gingrich around, that was the start of the visceral hatred between Democrats and Republicans that we still have today. Do you agree with that, Jeet?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the Willie Horton stuff and the nastiness of the 88 campaign really poisoned the well in a lot of ways and made us. But it is the case that when he was president, he did actually reach out to Democrats and was probably also going to be the last Republican president that was able to be bipartisan in that way and sign things like the Americans with Disability Act. And so Gingrich, I think, Gingrich does ramped up the partisanship to a much higher level. He took that sort of campaign mode of 88 and made it permanent. It became the sort of permanent campaign against the Democrats.
I see a question from Zach, and unfortunately we're not going to have time for it, but Zach, I will read it on the air. Zach calling us from Germantown, who says, I haven't heard any mention of the fact that H.W. Bush renounced his NRA affiliation after the Oklahoma City bombing. Gee, can you respond to that?
Yeah, no, again, that actually speaks to his kind of moderation. And the Republican Party has gone in the completely opposite direction, where it now accepts everything the NRA does.
Do you see Trump as the, excuse me, do you see Bush as an un-Trump?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that in his character, he was very different than Trump and in some of his governance. But he also, with things like Willie Horton, he helped pave the way for Trump. I think that's undeniable.
So how do you think he will be remembered?
I think he'll be remembered as, you know, the guy who straddled the line between sort of moderate Republicanism and the conservative movement and tried to balance the two, and was perhaps the last gasp of moderate Republicanism.
Well, on that note, Jeet here, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Again, Jeet here, staff writer for The New Republic. He wrote a piece about the former president titled The Whitewashing of George H.W. Bush. We also began our conversation talking with Joe Watkins, who worked with President Bush in the Bush White House as an aide. After this very short break, a conversation with John Meacham, who wrote a biography of George Herbert Walker Bush a couple of years ago. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Historian John Meacham will be giving a eulogy tomorrow for former President George Herbert Walker Bush's funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Meacham was a guest on Radio Times back in 2016 when his book about Bush, Destiny and Power, was first published. It's based on many interviews and on the diaries that Bush kept over the years. Today, we play an excerpt of that interview. So why did George Herbert Walker Bush want to work with you on this biography?
I'm going to use a technical term. I don't want to overwhelm you, but I groveled.
Did you?
I begged. I wanted to do it. I had first met him 17 years ago in 1998. Michael Beschloss, my friend, the historian, and I had gone to Walker's Point in Maine. And I immediately understood in a way I had never before when I met him how he had become president of the United States. He possessed a quiet, persistent charisma and embodied very clearly a fading order of public service. He had more in common, has more in common, I think, with Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt and even the Founding Fathers than he does with his successors. And when the opportunity arose and he said that he had these White House diaries, that I just jumped out of my chair as fast as I could because what he did a couple of times a week for 4 years is he would dictate into an audio recorder. So in many ways, and the book draws heavily, the presidential part of the book draws heavily on those diaries, it's as close as most of us are going to get to being president. He's a one-term president, but he had enough action in 4 years that most people get in eight. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the budget deal that set up the prosperity of the 90s, the terrible 1992 campaign, the end of the Soviet Union, tumultuous time, quiet but deeply ambitious and competitive president at the heart of it.
looking at his childhood, his upbringing, I mean, it seemed like a very stiff upper lip. It had a kind of British feel to it.
Externally, yeah. And that's one of the fascinating things is, yes, you're right. If you were looking at this boy growing up, born in Milton, Massachusetts, grew up in Greenwich, spent the summers in Maine.
Boarding school.
Andover, boarding school, Yale, the war. You would think of him as kind of having just stepped out of a John Cheever story or the Brooks Brothers catalog. But he is more complicated than that. He's more interesting than that. He would not have become president of the United States if he had only been that. If he hadn't moved to Texas in 1948 after the war, wouldn't have been president. The Democrats wanted him to switch parties in the early 1960s, back when there was one-party government down there. He refused. He barely got on the ticket with Ronald Reagan in 1980. Neither Bush would have been president had Reagan actually cut that deal with Gerald Ford. So his life is full of these near misses, and great biography, I think, is always the story of tension. And the tension in George H.W. Bush's head and heart was the mission to serve, taught him by his family, to whom much is given, much is expected, but the drive to succeed. And to serve in the way he wanted to serve, someone had to win, someone had to lose. And so you have this wonderfully complex interplay of ambition and service and duty all rolled up in this lanky guy from Greenwich. Yes, you know, he came from a privileged background, but we weren't really hiring him for that. 1989 to 1993 was a time of immense change in the world. And if I had told you, if you and I had been sitting here in 1980, and we would have said, all right, in 12 years' time, in a decade's time, the Soviet Union is going to cease to exist without a shot being fired, we both would have thought we were just whistling Dixie. And yet, because of both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, American leadership played a critical role. You know, they didn't end the Cold War. You know, the peoples of Eastern Europe, the peoples of the republics of the Soviet Union, the countless acts of courage, you know, it was their desire for freedom and independence that drove it. But Reagan helped, and Bush managed it. I think they needed each other historically.
Those two, Reagan and Bush.
I do. I think Reagan did things that Bush could not do in articulating a case for the West, and I don't think President Reagan could have handled the management details of the 4 years where George H.W. Bush – and, you know, go ask Mikhail Gorbachev.
In fact, you have an interesting – several scenes where Bush sort of holds his tongue in a way to give, I'm not sure it was exactly saving face, but it seemed like Gorbachev really appreciated his diplomacy.
Here's a connection between childhood and the presidency. In childhood, George Bush was known as half-half because whenever he had a treat, he would cut it in half and give the other kid half the dessert, half the candy bar. Cut to 1990, 1991, 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. He's able, half Bush, is able to put himself in the shoes both of Gorbachev and of those to Gorbachev's right in the Soviet Union. He's able to imaginatively see how he would feel if his system was falling apart. And he knew that the possibility of a violent reaction from Soviet hardliners was a real possibility. And one factor, and we all forget this, one of the reasons he thought that in November of 1989 is why. What had happened in June of 1989? Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
So he had seen a repressive regime take military action against protesters. The wall comes down. He plays it very cool. The Democrats and the press think he doesn't understand what's going on.
Because he's not celebrating.
Because
right?
He's not celebrating. What he's doing is he's trying to prevent another Tiananmen. And he doesn't get credit for it until now. But it was a brilliant diplomatic move, and it was based on his character.
It's hard not to think about those particular skills at that time and whether they would work today at all, you know, dealing with all the dictators and ISIS in the world, you know, whether those kinds of skills are translatable.
I'd love to have the chance to find out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a man who is the un-Trump. I mean, someone who spent his life training to be president. Someone who ambassador to the UN, envoy to China, chairman of the Republican National Committee, director of the CIA, vice president for 8 years.
Those would be disqualifiers today for a number of people.
You can't. You couldn't be nominated. I mean, imagine that paper trail. Just for any one of those jobs in particular, the UN votes, having run the RNC during Watergate, even though he called on Nixon to resign, he did it late. Director of the CIA, who China, 4 years in Congress. George H.W. Bush is a figure out of a world that has vanished politically. And that, centrism is not always the right answer. The middle way is not always the right way. But sometimes it is. And sometimes you need someone whose ambient reality is actually doing the business of governing. And that's what Bush did.
Well, some of his comments about Dick Cheney when he was vice president in his son's administration, also Donald Rumsfeld when he was Secretary of Defense in his son's administration, has gotten a fair amount of attention, calling them both hard asses or iron asses.
Iron asses,
I should say. And about Cheney, he said he seemed knuckling under to the real hard-charging guys who wanted to fight about everything, use force to get our way in the Middle East. He criticized Cheney for sort of creating his own department within, I guess, the Department of State. Rumsfeld, and I have a feeling that there's some rivalry that goes back between George Herbert Walker Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, but he doesn't seem to like Rumsfeld very much, calling him arrogant.
Which is probably the worst thing that George Bush could call you.
To call you arrogant?
Arrogant. I think that's true. But President Bush, 41, offered these criticisms to me in interviews from October of 2008 through about 2012. I confirmed all the quotations with him again last year before publication. He believed that his son's administration had an overly hawkish tone. He worried that Cheney was too eager to project force around the globe. He thought that Rumsfeld had failed to revisit decisions once made about the conduct of war, of the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. To my knowledge, it's the first time he's ever been this direct, this honest on these three questions. He said that he did not believe his son should have used the term axis of evil, that hot rhetoric was good at getting headlines, but might not be diplomatically useful. And I think the reason he's told me these things, I think, is he believes in the historical record. Mm-hmm. A man who keeps a diary for all those years wants the record to reflect reality accurately. And I think these were his issues with what happened. I don't think he thinks that Dick Cheney was really the president. I don't think he believes that, as he put it, George W. was not some dolt, some dummy going in there. He did, that conventional wisdom is not right. And I don't think he disagreed with him radically on the actual decision to go into Iraq.
Different times, but different response to Saddam Hussein.
Different wars, different reasons. They both told me, and strategic environment was different. But more than that, 41 wrote a letter to his son saying, ratifying his course. Mm-hmm. And in his own war in 1990-91, he was willing to risk impeachment if Congress had not given him the authority to go in, and he used the language of good versus evil. So, to some extent, was he criticizing in his son something that he was uncomfortable about himself? He wouldn't be the first human being to do that.
He called Lynn Cheney a iron ass as well, and seemed to think that Lynn Cheney and their daughter had undue influence on Dick Cheney himself.
Yeah, he was trying to figure out why the Cheney he had known as Secretary of Defense seemed so much more conservative. Cheney was always conservative, but he did bring Lynn and Liz into it. Vice President Cheney, he wore the iron ass label with a certain amount of witty pride. He did say that he did not agree with President Bush's putting it off on Liz and Lynn. They're two formidable women in their own rights, but it's interesting that that's what 41 was sitting around thinking about.
Yeah. What does he mean by iron ass?
Iron ass means inflexible,
data
resistant, stubborn to a fault. And I, you know, it's funny. I spent a long time on this book, and it may be remembered for the phrase iron ass.
Here we are talking about it on the radio.
Where's Bill Sapphire when we need it? The etymology of iron ass.
Let me ask you about Iran-Contra, because I have to say that even as you write about it, and clearly this is a man you respect and have a lot of admiration for,
sure,
that this was a really dark time for him and perhaps a time when he really went against whatever his values were. And is lie too strong a word?
No, I don't think so. He initially denied that there had been arms sales to Iran. George Shultz goes to him and says, "You were there. You know, you got to knock this off." The argument, as people may remember, was George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense, were arguing against the Arms for Hostages Initiative. The National Security Advisor, Oliver North, who was working for the NSC, President Reagan and President Bush, Vice President Bush, rather, were more or less for it. It was a misguided policy, backfired in many ways. And it made Bush appear to be someone who was not being fully candid by saying he was not in the loop. He knew plenty. So I think it's an uncharacteristic moment, but it was a Machiavellian one, where he was having to balance staying close to Reagan, who remained popular with the Republican base, and keep himself out of trouble. This is a man who was never really deeply ideologically wedded to either side, left or right. So he was not driven by a fervor in the way Oliver North was. So much so that, I mean, he was such ultimately a pragmatic figure as opposed to a movement conservative, that when he was president, he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act. He transformed almost every building in America for the disabled. He violated his own no new taxes pledge to put the country on a stronger fiscal footing. He signed the Clean Air Act, which is essentially still our environmental policy. He had a much bigger domestic record than people have appreciated. And I think the reason people don't appreciate it is it was too liberal for Republicans to embrace. And Democrats didn't want to give a Republican president too much credit. That's why history in this case matters.
Do you think he was also ruthless? I'm thinking about the campaign against Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads. I mean, the way that – and there were some others as well.
Yeah. I think that he was willing to say and do what he needed to do to win. What ultimately redeems him, in my view, is that whatever he did on the way to amassing power – once he had that power, he was able to put the country ahead of his own political interest. My favorite example is in 1964, when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he opposed the Civil Rights Act, now a piece of American scripture. But what does he do in 1968 when he's actually elected to Congress? He votes for open housing, lifting racial discrimination from the real estate market. So he opposes the act on the campaign trail, the big Civil Rights Act. But when he has a chance to vote for a civil rights measure, he votes against his constituents' wishes. He goes down to Houston, gets screamed at for going out and selling out to the left. He is one of the last figures of the American center.
That's historian John Meacham. He's giving one of the eulogies tomorrow at President Bush's funeral, which we are carrying live here on WHYY. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer. Debbie Bilder, John Aaron, and Alex Stern are the Radio Times producers. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me tell you tell you about a new way to be in touch with Radio Times. We've created a Facebook group where you can get some conversations that will happen after the show is over. You'll have a chance to talk with us and with each other, and we'll be giving you exclusive content. You can find a link on our Facebook page. In fact, we put a little video there to help you out. You can also type Radio Times listeners in the search bar, and you'll be signed up. We do hope that you will do it. It'll be fun.